Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Jeffrey West. He's the director of the Santa Fe Institute. We're going to be talking about science in many manifestations in his work and at the Institute. Right now, I'd like to welcome Anna Sofair. She is an archaeoastronomer and author of the new book, Chaco Astronomy, an Ancient American Cosmology. And Brian Vio joins us. He's a member of the Pueblo of Acoma tribe in New Mexico and is the museum director at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. And there will be a book launch tonight at 6 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe of this new book, along with a screening of the film The Mystery of Chaco Canyon, narrated by Robert Redford. Now, Anna Sofair, this is a very interesting thing that you, an artist turned archaeoastronomer, actually discovered about 30 years ago. Tell us about the nature of this discovery.
Well, I was in Chaco Canyon because I had a great interest in rock art. And I had joined a group of enthusiasts for rock art who were there as volunteers to record everything they could on the canyon walls. And the director of this effort, this field school, said, somebody needs to do Fajada Butte. And I'd only been out there a day when he said this, and there was a terrific climber there from Los Angeles who I saw was ready to go, and I said, I'll go too. And what happened was...
Now, to do Fajada Butte meant to record the rock art there?
Yes. And the first day we were up there, we recorded about 22 sites, and we decided we'd climb to the top to see if there was something more there. And when we got there, we saw a beautiful large spiral. But it was kind of late in the day, and we decided we'd come back when there would be more light for recording it. And so the next day, we happened to get there near noon, a week from solstice, and there was a beautiful dagger of light bisecting the spiral. And that began what is now a 30-year study project of Chaco.
Now, this dagger of light bisecting the spiral turned out to have astronomical significance. It wasn't a coincidence.
Well, yes, and I kind of knew that at the time because I'd been studying Mayan astronomy, actually, back in Washington, D.C., and I had witnessed some other shadow and light phenomenon, like the marvelous large serpent that climbs the pyramid at Chichen Itza. And about 3 weeks earlier, I had seen some slides from somebody who had recorded a figure in Baja, California, in a cave with a dart of light horizontally crossing the eyes of this little figure.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so you said, I can recognize astronomical phenomena when I see them.
Well, a solstice and light is something actually quite universal. I'd also seen it in Newgrange in Ireland, where a tomb that's 5,000 years old has a passageway that lights up just at winter solstice sunrise.
So what did you do then?
Well, I was naive enough to think, oh, this is just what it is, and I'll tell the people who might know something about Chaco and others who know about rock art and so forth. And nobody took much of an interest, and if they did, they tended to be a little skeptical. So then I realized, and it took several months.
Science? Who were these? Academics, scholars, archaeologists?
Various, yeah. People who knew a lot more about Chaco and Southwestern archaeology and rock art. Nobody seemed to kind of click with it or say, oh, that's very exciting, or, gee, I think that's what it is. A lot of people said, oh, it's just a coincidence, light on the spiral, and so forth. So then that pressed me to realize I had to work scientifically, and I was fortunate enough to have incredibly good colleagues in Washington who I met a few months later. A physicist, Rolf Sinclair, with whom I worked for 14 years, and we published 8 different papers and abstracts, and he was phenomenally helpful. And I also met an architect who'd been trained in Germany in shadow and light formation, and he kind of led the way in convincing the physicist. And in the end, we wrote a paper in Science magazine that pulled all that together and showed that the site not just marked summer solstice, but winter solstice with 2 dagger shapes on each side of the spiral bracketing it, and at equinox a little spiral with a dart of light through it.
Now, why do you call it dagger? Isn't dagger a very particular European instrument?
Well, we are Europeans. We are not Anasazi.
The Anasazi were.
Well, in truth, that is the shape it looks like. It may have meant more. I have thought, to be honest, that it could have looked like an awl to ancient people.
We're talking to Anna Sofair about Chaco astronomy. Now, what were the rock formations that were put in place in order to make this phenomenon, the solstice and the equinoxes and so on, appear on this spiral?
Well, there are three large rock slabs, and they're 6 feet to 9 feet in height. The highest one is 9 feet tall, and they lean against the cliff face so that their openings are to the south, southeast, and that allows these dagger shapes to form just as the sun is passing at those critical times.
And there was, I was watching the movie that's going to be screened tonight at the Center for Contemporary Arts. There was some controversy about whether those three slabs leaning up against each other were just naturally occurring formations.
Yes, that was an attitude or a response that we heard very often from geologists, some archaeologists, that it was just a natural rock fall. But as we learned more about the site and saw how those rock slabs had been once attached to each other as a block and attached to the cliff face, it was pretty clear that it would be extremely unlikely, if not impossible, for them to have moved into such verticality as they have.
And so what was the process of convincing the skeptics like, and also really probably convincing yourself as well?
Well, it was a scientific process. It was a lot of peer review internally amongst us. That's why Rolf Sinclair, I mentioned, was so good. He was at the National Science Foundation and very used to that process intellectually. And we brought other people in. And eventually, when you do publish in Science or Cambridge University Press, as we did over the years, you have to go through very, very rigorous peer review. And I think that was critically important. Because the last thing we wanted was to be waving our arms in the air and saying, oh, here it is, look at it. As, you know.
Isn't this pretty? I'm an artist.
Yeah. So I was extremely lucky that we had this interdisciplinary team that you see in the films and in the papers, who could bring across the various aspects of the site.
Brian Vio, you are the museum director at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque. What is your role in this astronomy project?
Well, I've been involved for many years. I think I first met Anna in the late 1980s when I was working for the Pueblo. And Anna had come to Acoma to present her findings, I think some of the initial reports that were produced, and had this desire to share this information with the descendant communities of Chaco, and Acoma being one of them. So at that point, I was really interested. I was immediately interested about this work and the research and all of the other information that I didn't realize actually existed about Chaco. And so at that point, I had been, I think actually it was a couple of years later when the tribal government there asked me to stay involved and monitor the activities associated with this research project. I eventually became part of Anna and the Solstice Project's advisory committee, and have been serving as a member of this committee since then. So we provide Anna and some of her colleagues with some traditional knowledge or information that helps her in her work, but also is of that we see as beneficial to the Pueblos in terms of documenting the history associated with Chaco.
So what is the benefit to the Pueblos, and how do you get information like this about Chaco out to the people?
Well, the Acoma, for example, has a historic preservation office and a tribal museum. So we're fortunate that we have those systems in place and or resources in place to disseminate information. We not only make that information available to the community, but we share the information with the appropriate tribal leadership and religious leaders. We have our own traditional knowledge associated with the history and the activities that occurred at Chaco. But it's always interesting for us to see how Western science and people in general, how they view Chaco and other ancestral homelands that we have. So it's it's interesting and important for us to know what is happening at these sites, to stay informed and be involved if we can in some of this work.
How would you characterize the differences and the similarities between how you at Acoma, how Pueblo people know things about, for example, astronomy versus the Western point of view about astronomy?
That's a good question. And I don't know that we, as collectively, as descendant communities, all agree on the same thing. You know, we have some very conservative Pueblos that are very protective of their traditional knowledge. So, you know, you don't really make those comparisons. It's inappropriate sometimes. So, for us, we, like I said, serve as a consultant to the Solstice Project, we being Acoma, and share what we can with not only Anna, but the Park Service officials who manage the site. It's also very important where collections are concerned, and the research, ongoing research associated with the Chaco sites. You know, we try to stay involved, and so we're not actually sharing traditional knowledge all the time, but we are providing guidance on the way in which maybe material culture is managed, and then also raise the red flag for these individuals as they are working in the site.
What do you mean, raise the red flag?
Well, if there are proposals for excavation or more excavation, you know, that's one of the times that we would raise that flag, because there has been so much work and research already done in that area that any more is just so damaging to the site. So we're very concerned about the physical well-being of Chaco and its sites. And then when information just gets too sensitive or the questions are just too sensitive, we will, you know, we either will not be responsive or we will just come right out and say, no, we are not interested in having this discussion, or in the Solstice Project's case, there might be some additional work, research that we don't feel is appropriate. And so, another example would be the publication, just like the new one here. You know, we have the opportunity, and I'm thankful to Anna for this, to review and provide comments and even have input sometimes to the books.
Anna Sofair, and by the way, for our listeners just tuning in, the book is called Chaco Astronomy, an Ancient American Cosmology. You came at this work as an artist. You went through this whole scientific peer review process, and it just makes me think about, for example, we had last week on the air Margaret Randall, who's a writer and poet, and she spends a lot of time trying to imagine how Puebloan people thought, lived, felt. You, as an artist, as a human being, must have come in contact with lots of different ways of knowing and learning and try to integrate those? I mean, I'm projecting onto you. What was it like for you?
Well, thank you for that question. But in truth, I'm actually kind of uncomfortable with the thought that I could think like the Chaco people. That sounds strange after publishing, what is it, 9 peer-reviewed papers here. But there is a boundary that I've kept and felt appropriate, or felt comfortable with, which is a boundary of science, and also appropriate in sharing what the data, the facts, what we find, the alignments over and over in the buildings to the sun and to the moon, and how it all builds up to that picture of an extraordinary astronomy. Sharing it with the Pueblos, but not interpreting as much as we cannot, we do not. And if you've seen the second film, The Mystery of Chaco Canyon, it is not our voice, my voice, that interprets so much as brings out that data. It is really Pueblo people who are descendants of Chaco who are giving it more of the sense, the cultural meaning. And that, to me, is a great relief and a great help. I couldn't do the work without not just Brian, who's been tremendous as a colleague, but many others for the beginning of the finding in 77.
So let's talk about it, and either one of you can answer this. First of all, what is the significance of the symbol of the spiral, and what was the practical or overall purpose of marking the solstices and the seasons with the sun so accurately?
Well, I'd like to maybe leap ahead to a question we haven't gotten to, which is what is also there, and that's the moon. And the thing about Chaco that I suppose in one or two sentences, if you had to say it, would be sun and moon. Because soon after finding the solar markings, we found a series of shadow markings of the long cycle of the moon. And we found it also in the building alignments, so that the extreme positions for the moon, just like the extreme positions for the sun, are incorporated in the shadow and light markings and in the building alignments, interbuilding alignments, even the geometry of the buildings. And finally, through another colleague, a colleague from then the University of Colorado, an astronomer, we found that Chimney Rock, an outlying community of Chaco, set on a precipice, is set right there, with an alignment to the moon rising between two towers of rock just at the extreme of the moon, the major standstill. So I think if you really want to know where this all comes to, it's the combination. It's the integration of those two cycles with each other at the same sites.
Right. And what is the purpose of that? What was the purpose of that, of marking those things so accurately?
Well, I think it... let me say it's not utilitarian, because there's really no use for the moon at this long cycle for planting. And one of the responses we so often got was, oh, a solar marking, that's for planting and that's for farmers. And it's so much more in Chaco. First of all, there wasn't very much farming, if any. There was some, perhaps. But people were not living in these great buildings. They were built as monuments expressing cosmology. And this is a tremendous shift. That really we're dealing with a place that was built elaborately as a sacred center in a not very practical location to express astronomical relationships, sun and moon.
The planting hypothesis does seem pretty out there, considering that level of accuracy is not necessary for knowing when to put your seeds in, is it, Brian?
Well, it's... It could be. And, you know, our ancestors migrated to Chaco from the Mesa Verde region. And it was part of their migration to various locations and to the present-day Pueblo communities. But there were significant activities that occurred at Chaco, and so it doesn't surprise me so much that so much time was spent probably not by the greater community of people at Chaco, but by certain individuals who had the responsibility to monitor and develop this method for managing time, observing time, observing the travels of the sun and the moon. This did not exist at their previous site to the level that it evolved at Chaco. So it was very ceremonial as well. It was a process that I'm sure involved a tremendous amount of sacrifice on the part of certain individuals for the greater good of the community. And we really believe that while people were at Chaco, that there was still a strong connection to this, to the spirit world. And so it was as a result of having that connection that people at Chaco were able to build the structures that were built, to develop this astronomy, if you will, at Chaco. Because a lot of those things were then carried on as the migration continued.
Right.
And so even today in your modern Pueblo community, we still manage our time based on the observance of the solar and lunar cycles. We plant, we have ceremony, we observe other things throughout these years that are very much the same system that you had at Chaco.
So let me get back to this question. What is the significance of the spiral motif? They're looking at each other.
Well, that's a hard one, actually, because there's so many interpretations that worldwide have been given for spirals. But I suppose, and I'm going to venture into what I said I wouldn't venture into interpreting Pueblo culture, but there is an image of movement toward the center in all the creation and migration stories. And I have been told by some Pueblo people that spiral moving into that center might be significant in that way. But we've also seen it, if you've seen the second film, the one that's showing tonight, as possibly representing the motion of the sun moving through the seasons. And that is shown over a petroglyph that's very significant, that looks like Pueblo Bonito, sun rising in the east, setting in the west, and turning through three cycles, lower and lower, turns into a kind of spiral.
We're talking to Anna Sofair and Brian Vio, and unfortunately, it's time to go. There's much more to talk about this book, and to do that, people can go to the book launch tonight at 6 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. The number over there is 982-1338, and there will be a screening of the film, The Mystery of Chaco Canyon. This is the one narrated by Robert Redford.
Yes.
And you will be signing books, and both of you will be there?
Yes.
Could you add that we would be signing books at about 7:30, and the screening would be at 6:10.
The screening is at 6:10,
but
very,
if people just want the book, they can come at 7:30.
Okay. Well, Anna Sofair, archaeoastronomer, and Brian Vio, member of the Pueblo of Acoma tribe in New Mexico and museum director at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Jeffrey West, director of the Santa Fe Institute. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Jeffrey West. He is the president of the Santa Fe Institute. He's a physicist, interdisciplinary scientist, actually, I should say. And he will be speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers in a talk titled The Complexity, Simplicity, and Unity of Life from Cells to Cities. That's tonight from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex at 123 Grant Street. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure to be here.
And so from the Radio Cafe to the Science Cafe, you are a physicist who, as I was reading on the internet as I was preparing for this show, had actually sort of gone to graduate school as a way to get from England to California and intended to stay there for a year or two and then go back and be an English major. Didn't work out that way.
No, indeed. I'm slightly embarrassed that you did so much research on this. But indeed, yes, I originally came from the United Kingdom to indeed have experienced California. I'd heard all these wonderful things about California. This is way back in the early 60s, and this was a great excuse to come for at least a year experience it and then go back and lead a real life.
But that's not
I got very turned on during graduate school to physics, which I majored in as an undergraduate, but had not really been passionate about. And more I became excited by some of the deep questions in physics and realized that physics was a structure using mathematics and a conceptual way of thinking that could answer many of the questions that I was still, as I emerged from my adolescence, were still deeply troubling me. And may I say, trouble me even more now that I'm well into my 60s.
What are some of these questions? I mean, are we talking about why are we here, that kind of thing?
Yes, even at that level, sort of why are we here questions. But really, you know, what is the origin of the universe? How did it evolve? How did life begin? What is the nature of consciousness? Those were the sort of sophomoric kind of questions. I don't mean that as a pejorative term. But
and you actually dealt with those in graduate school?
No, but I talked a lot about them. Lots of talk. And in fact, I think the thing, as I look back, that actually kept me in physics and in California, and this was at Stanford, was that I happened to be with an extraordinary group of graduate students who were very interested in similar kinds of questions. So a lot of the time, we're in places like this,
sitting around in cafes.
Or sitting in, you know, little dorm rooms, talking about such questions, and seeing where physics, how we could use physics as a tool for beginning to answer them. It was somewhat naive, but it certainly formulated my whole approach to science, namely the focus on fundamental questions, fundamental principles, and how one can make them quantitative, predictive, within a kind of mathematical framework. And that has pretty much been what I've tried to spend the 30 or 40 years since trying to do.
Now, you ended up as a faculty member at Stanford in California, and then you were doing particle theory in Los Alamos National Laboratories, and now you're at the Santa Fe Institute. You have crossed disciplines probably more than many scientists, or perhaps more than most scientists, in the sense that you took physics, particle physics, but you went into biology and started looking at big questions in biology.
Yes, indeed. So, as you say, I was at Stanford for a number of years as a faculty member, and then I was lured to Los Alamos to start a new particle physics group, and we assembled a wonderful group. It was very exciting, and even though I only intended to come for a few number of years, in the end, remarkably, I'm still here. I mean, I'm not at Los Alamos, but I'm still in New Mexico. And but that group that we put together also was very eclectic, reflecting again broad interests. After about 20 years of doing that, dealing with fundamental questions. In high-energy physics, particle physics, that is the question, what are the fundamental particles, what are the fundamental laws that govern the interaction between those particles, how does that relate to the evolution of the universe and the Big Bang, what's the nature of dark matter, all these kinds of questions. My interests in the 90s began to shift on a personal level into some similar fundamental questions in biology. And the one that originally stimulated me, interestingly enough, and it's natural enough, was the question of aging and death. Why is it that we're destined to age and destined to die? And how come that if you're a human being, you are destined to live for roughly 100 years? I mean, you may only live for 50 years, and you may actually be fortunate or to live for over 100 years, but you're not going to live for 1,000 years or a million years.
Or even 150 years.
Or 150 years even. And indeed, most human beings will live more than 10 or 15 years. So why is that? What sets the scale? And that was the kind of question that started to intrigue me and got me interested in generic, deep questions in biology. And that ultimately got me involved in the Santa Fe Institute, because the Santa Fe Institute is an institution that was set up to strongly encourage, or as a, how can I say it, a safe haven for people moving across disciplines, because one of the sad facts that has evolved in academia over the last 20, 30 years especially, and even more so in the last 10 years, has been the tremendous pressure to work on very specific, detailed problems and to discourage broader thinking, especially broader thinking that crosses across disciplinary boundaries.
Where does this pressure come from?
This pressure comes primarily from the reward system, namely questions of promotion, tenure, grants, grant proposals. The
so it's hard
grants.
To get tenure for writing so a book that addresses broader questions?
Well, it would be very hard if you were a physicist and several of your papers, most of your papers were dealing with applying physics to economics, or, you know, a collaboration that you might have had with an anthropologist trying to understand network structure of the Anasazi, for example. This would not get you tenure, and you would be hard-pressed to find anyone that would support that research. So that was recognized over 20 years ago by a bunch of very distinguished scientists, three of whom had Nobel Prizes, who were very concerned that kind of thinking, which is more risk-taking, more speculative, was more and more being suppressed, not necessarily consciously, just simply by the evolution of the academic landscape.
We're talking to Jeffrey West, president of the Santa Fe Institute. So let's cut to the chase here. Dogs live 8 to 16 years. Human beings live 80 to 100 years. Why?
Yeah, so this is a very... so one of the things you discover when you start thinking about these questions is asking... So first of all is to think about what is the framework of this question. The framework of this question is... what are the generic features? We're not going to be able to answer a question, let's talk about aging, how long Mary Charlotte is going to live, or how long Jeffrey West is going to live, but we may be able to answer how long will you live if you're a human being, an average human being, whose weight is of the order of 150 pounds. And at the same time, being able to answer the question you raise, if you're the average elephant, who may weigh, I don't know, many tons, how long do you expect to live?
So that's or the kind ferret, of, or snail,
or a snail,
earthworm,
or whatever.
Or planarian.
That's right. So when you start thinking about this, if you start thinking about aging and death, one of the first things you want to start thinking about is what in the hell keeps you alive in the first place? And the process that keeps you alive, the fundamental process, is called metabolism. It's what people are doing all around us in this cafe. They're eating and drinking to provide the constituents, the resources to metabolize, create at a fundamental level a substance called ATP, which is your currency of energy, and that allows you to stay alive. That feeds everything, that keeps you alive, everything from your circuitry, respiratory systems to your neural system. That keeps you alive. And one of the questions is, how does that change, first of all, as you change the scale of the organism? That is if I look at your metabolic rate, that is how much energy, how many food calories, for example, do you need per day to stay alive? Suppose you had, instead of being born a human being, you'd been born a mouse. How much energy would you require to be a mouse, or had you been a blue whale, how much that would require? So it turns out when you look at that data, you find something extraordinary. That is, here we have this tremendous diversity of organisms, and you also have, you're dealing with a system that is probably the most complex possibly in the universe, and yet when you look at how metabolic rate, the amount of energy you need per second to stay alive, how that scales, how that changes as you go from, say, a mouse to an elephant to a whale, up through human beings and giraffes, you find that there is a very simple, systematic relationship that allows you to characterize it. And mathematically, for those in the audience that have even a modest mathematical background, that scales as a what's called a power law with an exponent of 3/4. So let me explain what that means.
Okay.
in English. So that means that if I were to change, it's power to the 3/4, I said, and here's the 3/4, how it comes in. That is that if you were to increase the mass of the organism, the weight of the organism, by a factor of 10,000, that's 1 followed by 4 zeros, that's 4 orders of magnitude.
So mouse to
a very large mammal of the order, actually, of almost an elephant, actually. You would naively have expected, if you've increased it by a factor of 10,000, you've increased the number of cells by a factor of 10,000, you would require 10,000 times as much energy. But in fact, systematically, you only require 1,000 times as much energy, 3 orders of magnitude, 3 zeros after the 1. And that 3/4 is just a mathematical representation of the fact that if you increase by a factor of 10,000 or whatever the number is, you require a much smaller number amount of energy to actually sustain the organism. And this is a generic rule that not only works across all mammals, but indeed works across essentially all of life. That is, if you ask about the power, the energy required to sustain an individual cell, and you ask about the power to sustain a fish or a tree.
So small animals need more energy per body weight
exactly.
than large
so
animals.
Exactly. So there is an economy of scale, meaning that the bigger you are, your cells require less energy to function. And incidentally, one thing that is amusing is to ask, how much energy do we need? Well, we actually need the number that's on your Kellogg's cornflakes box that says 2,000 food calories a day that we're familiar with. So that's the number we're talking about. But what is amusing that most people don't recognize, if you translate that into scientific units, so to speak, watts, it's only 100 watts.
100
that is,
watts.
We operate.
One light bulb
we
burning
need a
all day long.
Oh, that's all we need to keep us alive, just to sustain ourselves. Now, in fact, the amount of energy you need to function, that is, sit around, have this chat, go do your shopping, and do your job. If you add all that up, it turns out that number is more like 200 to 300 watts, but it's still not very big. And it is a real representation of the extraordinary efficiency of life, and also represents the extraordinary inefficiency and wastefulness of leaving a light bulb on, because that light bulb effectively could be supporting someone that's starving in Darfur, effectively,
if you
could somehow
way,
translate
right.
it. So it's a real metric of...
Now, what is it about larger organisms that allows them to be more efficient? Is it something about surface area to mass, or what's the...
No,
what?
So the work that I got involved in... So let me just continue with that line of thinking first. So here we have this extraordinarily simple and remarkable relationship about the amount of energy, which is very fundamental, of course, to life, how much you need to stay alive. But what is even more fascinating, so first it covers all of life, no matter if you look at the microscopic, at cellular level, or organisms of any taxonomic group.
But and all life has cells that are essentially the same.
The same, effectively the same. So the other fact is that if you looked at any physiological quantity, such as heart rate, such as lifespan we talked about earlier, such as more complex things like the diffusion of oxygen across the surface of your lungs, if you look at time to maturity, you look at any quantity, we could sit here and talk about 100 such quantities, you find a very, very similar kind of behavior. That is the scaling in a very systematic way. So with also this quarter coming up as a universal kind of number, the number 4 plays a sort of magical universal role in all of life. And what it says is that in this sort of coarse-grained generic behavior, a whale is a blown-up elephant, which is a blown-up giraffe, which is a blown-up gorilla, which is a blown-up human being, which is a blown-up mouse. We're actually just scaled up in this very peculiar, non-linear fashion,
right.
well-defined by the equations of each other,
right.
actually. And the thing that we look at as great differences are actually very small perturbations on top of this dominant background universal behavior that unites us all. We're all representations pretty much of the same thing. So now go to your question.
Yes.
What underlies this? So when I started thinking about this, I came up with an idea, which I will talk about in a second. But I was very fortunate to start a collaboration through the Santa Fe Institute, even though I was not part of the Santa Fe Institute at the time, with a very distinguished ecologist named James Brown at the University of New Mexico. He had just arrived about a year earlier, and he's a very distinguished man, and a student of his named Brian Enquist, who himself is now becoming a distinguished biologist at the University of Arizona, professor at the University of Arizona. So when we put all this work together, here's what we suggested was the origin of all this. The origin is that underlying life, what sustains life, are the multiple networks of which we are comprised. So when you think of yourself, you think of yourself as this nice, smooth surface with a, you know, head and a body and arms and so on. But what is actually you, what is functioning as you, even your very brain, are in fact hierarchical branching networks. The most familiar being your circuitry system with a heart pumping blood through a hierarchy of arteries, leading down to capillaries, very much like a complex road network. And what you realize when you think about yourself is that you are, in fact, a conglomeration of such networks. You're a circuitry system, a respiratory system, a renal system, a neural system. If you look at pictures of your brain, it is structured this way. So that's who you are. That's who we are, we meaning all life. And so what we did is we started realizing that these scaling laws are actually a manifestation of the generic, universal, mathematical properties of these networks that are controlled by the physics and mathematics that are integral to network structures. We started putting together a theory based on that, based on the nature of these networks, a mathematical theory, which not only explained these rules, it naturally gave rise to this infamous quarter power, the three quarters, the 3/4 I mentioned earlier at the beginning on metabolic rate, but everything else. One of the things that came out of this was a remarkable universality in terms of things like all time scales in life, and conversely all rates. So time scales meaning things that we've discussed, lifespan, time to maturity, rates being things like heart rate, the rate at which we evolve. So these rates differ by enormous time scales. Evolutionary rates are...
Right, you can watch the evolution of moths, but not of human beings.
But not of human beings. But we do evolve, and we know the rate at which we've evolved. That is, technically, the rate at which nucleotides in your DNA have changed. We can measure such things. But there's time scales associated with that, but there's time scales associated with your heartbeat, heart rate. So what the theory says is that all of these, no matter what they are governed by a very simple mathematical law coming out of the constraints of networks, and that is, again, to use a technical language, a power law with a scaling exponent of 1/4, this 1/4, so that, for example, going back to the increasing of weight by 10,000, your metabolic rate only increases by a factor of 1,000, and your heart rate, according to this, only increases by a factor of 10. Let me go back now to the question of aging. Aging is a secondary effect in this, and that is that aging in this theory comes about through the continuous degradation that occurs through these networks. So the great irony of these networks is the following. These are networks that I said sustain you. But these networks also have what physicists call dissipative forces. That is, they have friction in them and they wear. They are continually wearing, just like even the pipes that water flows through your house and your plumbing, they wear.
And the circulatory system would be a direct analogy.
It wears. Now, we do repair. But natural selection is at work here, and natural selection only cares that, for example, if you're a human being, that we live only to 35 or 40, we produce 15 kids, 20 in our natural state, produce 15 kids, of which maybe 10 will survive. But once we've done that, natural selection doesn't care. It only provides enough repair mechanism. And indeed, there's a huge amount of energy we put into repairing ourselves to live to 40 or so. And one of the questions one could ask is how long, if you actually were to have a highly efficient repair system and you were free of disease, how long could you conceivably live? And this theory answers that question in principle, and although it's a highly complex phenomenon, but it does give rise to the theory, if you take this wear and tear version and apply the network mathematics, you discover that the scaling of lifespan is indeed of this nature, this quarter power. You can also apply it to other things like evolution. You can apply it to sleep. I mean, one question that one might ask is, why is it we need to sleep? Why do we need to sleep? And why do we need to sleep 8 hours? Why can't we get by with an hour? And why is it that a mouse has to sleep 16 or 17 hours? And the theory similarly can answer that question, because it's surprisingly related to aging and mortality, because just as I said, you age because of the degeneration of the system due to these dissipated wear and tear forces, so it is within your brain. But the brain, of course, is a very unique and special organ, because it controls everything. It is the central control system. And you better repair that brain faithfully, because if you don't, there will be a continuous change in the individual. And furthermore, if you try to repair it while it's operating the whole system, you will have serious problems. So you need a downtime. Just as if you're in New York City, if they want to repair Fifth Avenue, they have to do it at night. They have to shut down everything. That's what we do. We have to do that on a daily basis. We shut down so that we can make the repairs. And if you go through that whole mechanism, you can discover why it is that a mouse has to sleep 16 relative to a human being sleeping 8. And guess what? How long do you think an elephant has to sleep?
4 hours.
It does indeed. It sleeps 3 or 4 hours.
Well, on that note, we are going to go into our waking day. Jeffrey West, I want to thank you so much for being here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Jeffrey West is president of the Santa Fe Institute. He's a interdisciplinary scientist, particle physicist, and he will be speaking today at the Science Cafe for Young Thinkers in a lecture titled The Complexity, Simplicity, and Unity of Life from Cells to Cities. We didn't even get into the part about cities.
Cities are our cities, great big organisms.
Exactly. And is
New York just a scaled up Santa Fe?
Well,
that's the kind of question.
Or it's just a scaled up mouse. We will talk about this, I'm sure, on another Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And in any case, the lectures today from 6 to 8 in the evening at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Street in Santa Fe. So, all this and much, much more in this wonderful city of Santa Fe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Colors of Jazz. By the way, if you want to email me, my address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Or you can leave a message at 428-1528. You can listen to podcasts, which means you can listen to the show archived at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. And all that is thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. Okay, I am out of here. We will see you very soon. Keep your dial tuned to KSFR, ksfr.org, streaming on the web. Hasta la vista. Ciao.